WERU FM, P.O. Box 170, East Orland, Maine, 04431.
And the time is just about 1 minute before the hour of 10 o'clock. Stay tuned for Bella Johnson and Alternative Currents.
Support for public affairs programming on WERU comes from Coastal Enterprises Incorporated, CEI, a private nonprofit community development organization offering financing and technical assistance to small businesses, social service facilities, and affordable housing projects throughout Maine. 882-7552.
Good morning, this is Bella Johnson. Back in November of 2000, concerned about the results of the presidential election, or as some say, selection, I was leafing through the Utney Reader when I found an article written by Paul Rogat Loeb, activist and author of Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Cynical Times. I immediately contacted him without ever reading his book, and he graciously agreed to do this interview. I've remained on his email mailing list, which you too can explore by accessing his website, www.soulofacitizen.org. As we head into another election year, many of us have some very deep humanitarian concerns affecting others in our world, but also our environment. What can we as simple global citizens do? Perhaps we can gain some inspiration from this rebroadcast of December 1st, 2000. It's as timely now as ever. We join the interview already in progress.
Larger community issues while others feel overwhelmed or uncertain, what it takes to maintain commitment for the long haul, and how involvement can give back a sense of connection and purpose rare in purely personal life. Some of the lessons Loeb offers are that our efforts can do more for ourselves and for the world than we may ever imagine. We don't have to become saints or wait for the perfect situation to take action. Change happens little by little, step by step. We can savor the journey of engagement, even though our ultimate destination is unclear. And that the impact of our efforts will often ripple outward in ways we can't predict. Paul Rogat Loeb is an associate scholar at Seattle's Center for Ethical Leadership and has written on social involvement for the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Psychology Today, Utney Reader, Redbook, Parents Magazine, Christian Science Monitor, Mother Jones, The Village Voice, and others. He has been interviewed on CNN, NPR, PBS, C-SPAN, and more. His other published works include Generation at the Crossroads, Apathy and Action on the American Campus, Nuclear Culture, and Hope in Hard Times. More about him can be accessed on his website, and this is all one word, small letters, soulofacitizen.org. Paul, welcome to our show.
Hey, glad to be here.
So glad you showed up. Could you tell us first what motivated you to write such a book?
Well, I've been working on these kinds of issues for a long time. In some ways, almost 25 years. And the question is basically what makes people participate and why they don't, and you know, why is it with all the crises in our time and in our society and in our planet, why don't more of us do anything about it? And I was talking, I mentioned I've written three earlier books, and they're all sort of coming at these questions from some angle or another. And I was talking at a bookstore, and a friend of mine said, you know, this is great stuff, but you ought to come at it just really directly because people have all these questions, you're answering them in wonderful ways, they love the answers, but they're sort of in and around, almost like hovering around your book. So what if you wrote a book that just directly dealt with all these issues and people would find it useful? So that was what she said, and I think, in fact, she was right. And so that was the genesis of Soul of a Citizen, which is just basically the dialogues that I was having with lots of good people and this suggestion of a friend of mine.
You mentioned in your introduction, and I quote, increasingly a wall now separates each of us from the world outside and from others who've likewise taken refuge in their own private sanctuaries. We know the truth of this statement here in northern New England, where we live so far and few between. Can you give us some thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I think the wall that I was referring to is less the wall of, you know, physical separation and isolation, which maybe is a different situation. I would suspect that probably you folks, even if you're further from your neighbors, maybe you know them more or in some ways possibly more connected. But then if you look at many of our communities, people are living right next door to each other, but they don't even know the people down the block. And so what I'm really referring to is the kind of less physical space than the way in which we're just kind of convinced that we can live wholly on our own, wholly in isolation, that we don't need other people, that, you know, the sort of prevailing rhetoric of our culture, you make it on your own, you make your own chances, all that stuff, that to me is all, I would say, all that nonsense. And what it does is it cuts us off from each other. So even though we may be living in, you know, some place where people are, you know, can see each other on the street, you drive into the driveway, you park your car inside, get in through the door at the back of the garage, and you maybe never even talk to your neighbor. And I think that's part of that larger trend of isolation in our society, you know, where we spend a lot of time, you know, watching TV, on, you know, maybe even feel like we connect a bit on the internet. But I think that the kinds of face-to-face interactions have been dropping to some degree, and I think that's dangerous.
Yeah,
well, you know, much less the ability of our ability to be able to take on larger public issues, which, you know, is absolutely critical.
Yeah, I think the physical distance, as you were saying, it's maybe a different challenge, but it's all the same when it comes down to the isolation factor. Many would say that we have little enough time for family and friends as it is. How could we begin to initiate community involvement, and how could it benefit us to do so?
Well, it's true that we're very pressured in this culture. I mean, if you look at the numbers, we work a whole lot more hours than we did 25 years ago. I mean, it's almost like an extra month of work, because work week's gone up to about 50 hours a week from 40, and that doesn't even count commute times, which are, you know, often very long. And so what happens is we do feel like we have less time to spend with family and friends. We do feel pressed. And here's the question, though. If we simply accede to it, if we say, well, okay, that's just the way it is, then I think things get worse. I mean, if you look at the issue of the workday, it was the central issue of the labor movement for about over 100 years. There was an 80-hour work week, and there was a 70-hour work, and they fought to get it down to 60, and they fought to get it down to 50, and they fought to get it down to 40, and then somewhere right before World War II, it stopped, and it sort of stayed pretty stable from there until 1970, 73, and then it started creeping up. And so in a sense, what we've done is we've let the ball roll back down the hill, and I don't know, we use that metaphor, as we kind of roll back on top of us in some level. You know, that is, we all feel the weight of it. So I think that's one aspect of you know, of just issues we have to take on. The other thing is that I find a lot of times what happens is that we come home, we're exhausted, and yet the kinds of ways that we sort of respond to that exhaustion in isolation don't necessarily, they don't change anything about the situation, and they also don't give much back to us when we're sitting there watching the tube or whatever. And yet, when I find myself actually working with some people on an issue that I care about, that gives me energy, because part of the exhaustion, I think, is the sense of watching things go on that you know are wrong. You know, you hear about an election, you know, in some ways stolen away. You hear about an environmental crisis. You hear about, you see somebody on the street with a sign saying, I'll work for food, whatever it is. And you want to do something, and then you don't. It takes something out of your gut. One of the people I quote in Soul of a Citizen, actually my closest friend is a fisherman who does wonderful, wonderful environmental work and built these great coalitions with environmentalists and family fishermen. He says, yeah, of course there's a cost to acting of time and whatnot, and, you know, you're running here and there, and you're up late at night writing a letter, and maybe you miss some of your kids' softball, you know, baseball or soccer games, you know, although you can still go to others. And it's, of course, you know, it's not as if it's completely cost-free. But then on the other hand, let's recognize two things. One is there's a cost to silence. When you are silent on an issue that matters, and you know matters, it just cuts something out of your gut. And he said the other side is that when you're with a group of good people, you do something and actually make change, well, you get something back. It's really powerful. And I remember, it's interesting, my friend Pete, that's his name, Pete Knudsen, they were part of what happened because they were so successful in building environmental alliances, that one of the issues they were dealing with, they deal a lot with salmon habitat, and what they say is, if you take care of the habitat, we'll have a salmon run, and if you don't, we'll destroy the salmon run. And we, as salmon fishermen, have a vested interest in preserving the habitat. And so what happened is, because they started getting successful and putting pressures on the timber companies, and they put pressure on some of the aluminum companies in Washington State, depend a lot on real cheap electricity, and they wanted to spill more water over the dams to help the salmon runs, and the aluminum companies resisted this. So they basically bankrolled, these big industrial interests bankrolled, a sort of a pseudo-environmental initiative, supposedly about protecting seabirds, but the actual aim was to knock the commercial fishermen out. And Pete sort of immediately moved into action and started bringing in people from the Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth and whatnot to sort of say, well, this is not an environmental initiative, and, this is just absolutely a con. But still, they were up against some pretty powerful forces, and I remember him sitting in a tavern with three other people in Seattle saying, we're going to take on the aluminum companies. We're going to take on, like, Reynolds and Kaiser as well. We'll go down fighting if we have to. But, it's pretty unlikely that we may not win. But we got to do it just for our integrity. But what was interesting is that, in fact, they did win. That they mustered enough support from the environmental groups. They brought in Native American tribes. They even crossed some expected political lines by some of the fishermen were members of Pentecostal churches like the Assemblies of God. And they talked to their preachers, and my friend's a son of a Lutheran minister, so he has his bumper sticker saying Jesus was a gillnetter on his back of his car. And they talked to them and sort of bridged a kind of common language, and you ended up with an Assemblies of God preacher giving an invocation against corporate greed on the steps of my state capitol in Olympia, which is absolutely astounding thing to happen. And that the day that they actually won the victory, I was there, and you saw Native American people from the tribes, and you saw fishermen, and you saw people from Friends of the Earth, and you saw some of these Pentecostals, and they're all sitting there toasting each other and celebrating. And I'm thinking, this is a very unlikely and a very wonderful coalition. And it came about by my friend Pete taking the risk of reaching out in all sorts of unexpected quarters, but also taking the risk of saying, yeah, I know that fighting this issue is going to be hard, and I know that there may be a cost, but I know that also that there's a cost to giving up, and I'm not willing to settle for that cost.
I want to get back to this election thing that you ran over a little while ago.
Oh,
but,
sure.
But yes, I do. But I want to address the article that you sent me a few weeks ago on Rosa Parks that you had, I believe, published in the L.A. Times.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because this is the kind of person that I think we all kind of think was just an average, everyday person who just did one act and that was that. Can you kind of run that story
accurately? I've been thinking a lot about, what do we know about how the societies change, and particularly about how our own societies change. And it seems to me that we know very little, and there's only a few people, actually, who we know about. We know about Martin Luther King, and we think we know about Rosa Parks, and maybe we know Malcolm X, and I think it gets pretty scarce after that. Maybe Susan B. Anthony of the suffrage movement, maybe not. So I was thinking about, if we don't know how people have changed things in the past, how are we going to know how to change things now? This is one of the central themes of Soul of a Citizen, is trying to learn from as many contexts as we can. And what struck me is this. I was on CNN a few years ago being interviewed, and Rosa Parks was going to be on the show, the Martin Luther King Day show. And Parks, I was so excited because, to be with a sort of living legend, even though she was going to do it by phone. And then what happened is they started introducing her, and they said, we're so glad to have Rosa Parks. One day she was riding on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and she refused to move to the back of the bus. That helped start the civil rights movement. That was all they said. I'm thinking, they've completely got the story wrong, because it makes it sound like she acted alone. She acted out of nowhere. One day it just sort of happened, kind of almost like on a whim, and she decided not to move to the back of the bus. And in fact, the real story is that she'd been an activist for 12 years, civil rights activist. She joined the NAACP, small little group. I mean, she was a seamstress, sewed clothes at a department store. The head of it was a sleeping car porter who took people's bags on the trains. And not people of any kind of power or standing. And they tried different things. They tried to learn from other cities that had civil rights efforts themselves, and they would meet, and they would try different campaigns. They even went to a the summer before the events that we've all heard of, Rosa Parks went to a training session at a place called Highlander School, which is a labor and civil rights center in Tennessee. And so it absolutely came out of conscious common action, not just kind of a whim. And she didn't act individually. She acted as part of a community, and there was a community ready to respond. And it took a lot. It didn't instantly change things. It took a lot of perseverance. I mean, obviously, if she stopped in the 10th year, we'd never have heard about her. She, you know, 12 years from the first time she gets involved to the events we've heard about, and another 10 years till the Civil Rights Act is signed. And so it just seemed like kind of a metaphor for all the ways that we bury the truth about how people change things. And my gut instinct, and I speak at colleges all the time, and that's how I make my living mostly, and I always ask the students, like, how the different versions of the stories seem to them. What they'll say is that basically the one that we get on the media, in fact, I remember Garrison Keillor last January on Prairie Home Companion saying, Rosa Parks wasn't an activist, she was just a woman with her groceries who was tired. So that image makes it sound like she's so impossibly heroic that we could never imagine ourselves ever being able to take a stand. Rosa Parks is great, but, you know, who are we? We're not Rosa Parks. Whereas if people know that, in fact, it started from this really humble, small beginning, they're much more likely to feel inspired by it. So, it's a central theme of Soul of a Citizen that people don't just sort of emerge out of nowhere. And what happens is, in fact, that you take something step by step, you learn as you go, you get a little more confidence, you get a little more strength, and that's the way that people become socially involved.
Now, one other thing, you had mentioned the I'll work for food sign on the street, and I really resonated to this myself when you say it demeans you as a human being to see such people and see such things, and how is the average person to respond to that?
Well, I think I'm not even necessarily saying that if somebody has that food, that sign, that the most important appropriate thing for you to do is to stop and find them the job or work for food. I mean,
oh, sure.
We only have, you know, we have limited time and limited resources. And so maybe that is the right thing to do, and maybe it isn't. But I am saying that in a world, in a society, one of the richest countries in the world, where that happens in every city, we damn well better do something about it, about the cluster of issues that it represents. So, you know, we may say, okay, I'm going to put my resources into trying to ensure that everybody has a roof over their head and everybody has food. And, you know, to me, that's probably the way to go. Because you just have a lot more leverage than you do as an individual, unless you're Bill Gates or something like that, and most of us certainly aren't. So what it's about is saying, this is the sign that says to me, we have some problems, and I'm going to take those problems seriously, and I'm going to do something to address the common issues. And it's hard because we do have to limit what we do in the sense that we cannot take on every single issue in the world. But what we can try and do is to join the issues, and we can try and say, I'm going to work on these kinds of issues that have to do with justice. I'm going to work on these kinds of issues that have to do with the environment. I'm going to try and bring the two together so that it's not seen as a trade-off of one or the other, because I think that's a false myth. And when I do that, there's going to be some progress, and people are going to be more connected with a sense of, yes, I can do something. It's possible to have a voice.
Yeah, and certainly easier to do that with something that you feel passionate about or something that continually triggers you on the street, so to speak. Yeah.
See, there's a notion, a kind of trap that I describe in Soul of a Citizen called the perfect standard, which is the notion, works a couple of ways. You have to know everything about an issue before you take a stand. You know, every 17th decimal point statistic, every possible argument that you need to be able to be ready to debate Henry Kissinger on Nightline at the drop of a hat, any of that kind of stuff. And one of the other ways that it works, so what happens essentially is that people feel like, I'd like to care about this, I do care about this, but I don't know enough, and who am I? But then it also works with a sense that says, well, how do I know that this is the right, perfect issue? And I'll think about one issue, and then I'll think about another issue, and I'll think about another, and by the time I'm done thinking about all of them, I'll be so tired, I just don't have the energy left to deal with any of them. And so I've seen lots of people get stuck in that, and my answer to that is, well, pick one, pick two, start on something, see where it leads, but don't get perpetually caught in the notion that I'll just have to wait forever until I know that it's absolutely the perfect issue.
Right.
Because there never is going to be a perfect issue, or the perfect circumstance, or the perfect time in our lives.
And if you never take the first step.
And if you never take the first step. Yeah, and we're never going to be perfect people. And that's the other image. I mean, I remember some students in Minnesota who were doing a sleep out around homelessness, and somebody sort of, they had these sort of cardboard shanties, and somebody said very cavalierly to the woman, well, you've got blankets, as if this is a crime, and the woman said, you know, it's freezing. Didn't sleep at all. And the woman said, well, you're being hypocritical. Homeless people don't have blankets.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like, she said, she was talking about it afterwards, she said, you know, maybe if I got pneumonia, would she have listened? She said, nah, she wouldn't have listened. You know, she would have said, I was just being hypocritical. I was being, you know, I wasn't being hypocritical, I was trying to be a martyr. And I think that that's, you know, what happens is that we define activism in a way that allows us not to act at all. It makes it impossible. And that's it.
I think what I'd like to do, it's a little bit early for a break, but I think I want to take one because I want to get into this election thing after the break. So
okay.
If you'll hang in tight, listeners, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back. To remind you that you're listening to Alternative Currents on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor. This is Bella Johnson, and I'm here this morning with Paul Loeb, author of Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Cynical Times. And we're back. Paul, you had spoken about the election, and I want to touch on this a bit because I know you've got some valuable information to share with people about this. And
in fact, I sent out last night my 1,000 closest personal friends, my email list, some thoughts on things that in fact still can and should be doing with the election. So it's definitely on my mind.
Shoot.
Well, basically, it strikes me a couple of things seem to be really important. One is I'm really disturbed by what's happened in Florida, and essentially the focus has been on the sort of hanging chads. But if you look at what occurred in Palm Beach County, there are essentially 22,000 people who had their votes taken away. We're talking about 3,500 almost entirely Jewish precincts, which ended up where they're voting for Buchanan, which even Pat Buchanan says is just, this is not his constituency. We're talking with 19,000 double-punched ballots. And things that's occurring that disturbs me is just much of the media coverage treats these people as sort of like, senile idiots or something like that. Like, well, if they don't have enough intelligence to figure out a ballot, then they shouldn't be voting. But if you actually look at the stories that are coming out of the place, and I've gotten a lot of them on email, and interestingly, the New York Times did quite a good piece about a week and a half ago, but it didn't get picked up anywhere else, which is very odd because usually stuff in the Times kind of ripples out everywhere, detailing the kind of chaos that was occurring in Palm Beach, where essentially ballot clerks were instructed not to help people with the ballot because it would supposedly delay things. So people were asking, getting no answer, when the clerks did in fact try to call for their headquarters for how to deal with the situation. The lines didn't answer, and then when they finally did get through, they were told, "Don't bother us." And in fact, there's a good number of documented cases where people asked for a second ballot and said, "Oh my God, I've just voted for Pat Buchanan," or "Oh my God, I've just punched two punches because I thought I was voting for Gore Lieberman," and they were refused it, which is absolutely illegal in Florida law. So that whole area is just, it's dropped out of, I think because perhaps it's a harder legal case to call for a revote than for a recount, it's just dropped out of the issue. So there's that question. There is the, obviously immensely partisan Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, who simply sort of capriciously said, "Sorry, you don't have enough time to count the ballots. We're not going to accept your revised ballot." There's the Republican mob in Palm Beach, in Miami-Dade, where they're basically coming in. They're like flying people in from Arkansas and whatnot, putting up in hotels, and they're physically almost attacking people who are trying to count the vote, and they stop counting the vote and don't get an extension to be able to do it in proper time because Miami-Dade is a very big county. It's the seat of Miami. And so what you have is basically a situation where leave aside that Al Gore, who I'm not particularly fond of, very, very reluctantly voted for, that he won nationally by 300,000 votes, which is a larger margin than Kennedy-Nixon and the Nixon-Humphrey races combined. Leave that aside. What you're seeing is basically the kind of raw kind of power politics in Florida, where they're basically not counting people's votes. Now, and add on to that all sorts of stories that have been coming out of intimidation of African-American voters, with Highway Patrol ticketing them as they come in to vote, and whites getting waved by, while blacks get asked for double ID, people being told that they are not on the rolls because they're convicted felons, even though they aren't, not being able to file a challenge ballot. And so there's all these stories that if you're in sort of, I guess what I call the email network, that I tend to verify stuff, so I check out the source and whatnot, because that's what I do as a journalist, that you find out about. But very little of it is made the media, because all they've been doing is talking about the chads, which obviously important. What happens in these machines is that, the inventor of the vote punch machine said, they're very prone to problems in a situation like this, because you punch and it doesn't always get detached, and it depends on the backing, and yes, of course, a hand count is more accurate. And so what occurs is that you get the story about the chads, and people are following that, and you get the court fights back and forth. But what you don't really get is the heart of the story that's necessary to understand how many votes were actually lost unfairly, in some sense, in Florida, which is the ones in Palm Beach County. I mean, if you add 22,000 votes in, And it's a very big, you know, it's not a big margin, but it's bigger than Iowa, Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Oregon, a bunch of other states. And that completely changes the whole dynamics of it. And so what bothers me is that most of the media, at least in the places I've been, and I travel around a lot, so in the last couple of weeks, I think I've been to, you know, Utah, California, Oregon, and Washington, which is, you know, several different states. I've not seen those stories getting out nationally except in the most peripheral ways. And so one of the things that I think people ought to be doing is, I mean, going to their local papers and saying, look, you got to run this stuff. It's important. Or, you know, their local radio stations or even their local TV network. You got to talk about this because we're relying on you to understand this.
But, you know, this has gone on for so long, and people just seem to be so tired of the whole election fiasco. It just seems as though a lot of people would just as soon see some kind of conclusion, even if it's a wrong conclusion,
well,
just to get it over with.
See, here's what bothers me. The day after the election, there were the pundits all weighed in. R.W. Apple, the New York Times, the guy on MSNBC. I mean, 90% of them all said, Gore should concede. Gore should concede. And to me, again, and I'm not somebody who particularly likes Al Gore, but if in fact, well, not hypothetical, majority of Americans clearly voted for Al Gore by 300,000 vote margin. So then we go down, okay, that may be, people say, well, that's nice, but the law says it's based on the Electoral College, and the Electoral College is for Bush. But if in fact Florida is not being counted fairly, then what it does, I think, is it basically robs people of their democratic rights.
Right,
and that's a very serious issue. I mean, it's not as if suddenly, I mean, I don't see airplanes falling out of the sky and factories grinding to a halt and, you know, I don't know, gas mains exploding because the presidency isn't decided. It's not as if the extension of this election uncertainty in any way suddenly creates catastrophe. What it does is it means that we've got to live with a little bit more ambiguity. But you take the trade-off. The trade-off is we live with some more ambiguity, and you're trying to have justice done. Or you say, well, I guess that's just the way it is, and you make a very consequential decision that essentially robs me of the right of my vote to count in Washington State, which went for Gore, as did Maine, I think, right? Is in some sense part of a larger agreement that says, I trust that things will be counted fairly elsewhere as well.
And then that cynicism sets in, which is where I'm trying to go with this, and saying, you know, what do people do? Well, it's like, okay, now it doesn't matter who I voted for because it ultimately comes down to the Electoral College or some other disempowering kind of thing to the average voter. So why bother to vote?
And I think that, you know, one of the things that would terrify me about happening out of this election is that occurred. And it's possible. I mean, people may see, certainly those black voters in Florida, you know, may say, well, God, we went in, we turned out, they threw away, one county, I think it was Duval, 25,000 of the 40,000 votes that were discarded for various things were, you know, from black precincts. I mean, you know, why even bother? I think there's the other way to look at it, a couple ways. One is to say, yes, this is we're up against. I mean, to me, the Electoral College is a miserable way to run a national election, and it's a direct legacy of a morally dubious political compromise where essentially the southern slave states wanted more power, feared they'd be outvoted by the North, and therefore demanded this to join when the Constitution was set up. It has nothing to do with democracy, and the rhetoric about, well, they'd visit small states. I don't know. Did anybody go to Maine? Did either of them ever go to Maine? I mean, I know the Bush has his, you know, summer houses and family houses, but I didn't see them campaigning in the small states.
Yeah, they both came.
They did? Okay, because it was a swing state. All right. But to me, what it really does is it simply says, you know, it creates a kind of capricious situation like this. You know, and it creates a situation where essentially the will of the people isn't ignored. I mean, it's ignored. And so you know, that's troubling. But regardless of the particular solution, I mean, one thing this election does prove is that small numbers can matter. I mean, you know, whichever way it is in Florida, if you do exclude the 22,000 votes, which is not that many for, you know, say, Florida, then you end up with, you know, 500 votes swinging at 600, 1,000. I mean, I go talk at colleges. All the schools I talk to have 1,000 students. Any high school has 3,000, 1,500 students who are graduating. I mean, you know, there's churches that have, you know, 2,000 members. I mean, we're talking about very, very small numbers. And, you know, if you say, let's look at Florida, just forgetting who wins, Florida, Arizona, Florida, Oregon, New Mexico, Wisconsin, Iowa, New Hampshire, maybe there's a couple of others, Missouri to some degree. You know, these are states where extraordinarily small percentages could have swung things. Well, Arkansas could have swung things one way or the other. And in a way, what that ought to do is remind us that our votes do count. And we just finished an election in Washington State where our senator, our incumbent senator, was defeated by, you know, a tiny margin of votes. It looks like, you know, there's going to be a recount, but it looks like the margin's safe, legitimate, and the rest. I mean, I'm glad of it because I didn't like the guy. And, you know, this sometimes happens, and I think it's a reminder to us that the votes do count. You know, are there things in the process that need to be seriously addressed? Absolutely. I mean, serious problem. But to me, it shouldn't be tempting for it to feed cynicism. And the more the media sort of disdains the results, the more likely it is to feed cynicism. But I also think it could work the other way and make us recognize that, yeah, our votes do count, and we also need to do what we need to do, whatever we can, to make sure that the results are taken seriously, are counted in a fair way, that the process is fair. I mean, you know, there's a whole issue that aren't even on the table, which is, for example, in, I don't know what the Maine law is, but in Florida, if you're ever a felon, and you may have been 30 years ago, you can never vote. And one-third of African-American men in Florida, I think it's 140,000, fall into that category. That's kind of interesting, especially when you've got a possible President Bush who says, I didn't commit a felony in 27 years, presumably referring to, you know, cocaine use or something like that. Because if he had been caught 27 years ago for whatever it was, and if he had gotten equitable justice as opposed to rich man's justice, he would have that on his record, and he wouldn't be able to vote in Florida. I'm not even quite sure what the law is on the presidency. You know, so if you look at that, 140,000 people, that's a lot of people to be disenfranchised. And you know that they're predominantly low-income people, and because those are the people who can't strike the fancy plea bargains and get the fancy lawyers, you know, and you get sort of diverted into a nice rehab program, you know, even if rehab, in fact, is the solution for everybody. You look at that, you know, it's an issue almost no one's talked about, but I mean, and that's true in, you know, I don't know what the law is in Maine, but, you know, I think it's 15 states where if you ever, it can be 30 years ago, if you've ever committed a felony, you can never vote, you know, which to me is not exactly a good way to reintegrate people into society and give them a stake and make them feel like, you know, if they play by the rules, then they'll be respected. So lots of issues around it.
So what can we do at this point? I mean, by Friday, this may be a moot point. We're recording this Monday, audience.
Right. It may be a moot point. I would say that the most important thing is to try and get the stories out. You know, write letters to the local papers. I mean, you can go, I mean, the, maybe I'll, slap. I think I will, there'll be a little, well, no, there won't be a time delay because I'll slap it up on my website at least temporarily. Some of the powerful stories about the election. Go to the website, which is www.soulofacitizen.org, and there'll be a button that says election crisis, and I'll put some stuff up that people can actually look at. That's very powerful. That, you know, maybe if they have a little more time to go into, because it just seems to me that matters. I think trying to get, I mean, Maine has interesting elected officials. They're sort of, you know, relatively independent minded Republicans who sometimes vote one way and sometimes vote another way and sometimes buck their party lines. And, you know, that isn't true in all places. I would put pressure on them to say, let's, you know, yeah, you're a Republican senator, but nonetheless, you also, you know, have been, you know, at some point you've had a sense of fairness. And look at this and speak about this as, you know, as a individual of integrity. And don't be silent, even if it happens to buck your party line. I think that's worthwhile. You know, the newspapers, the local media, just talking about these issues, because, you know, whatever gets resolved by the court, this has significant effects. And I think that if, at the very least, if we end up getting a president who comes in Kansas City, Bush, because of, you know, this highly dubious mandate, then people should know that. And they should take that into account in judging the actions of the administration. I think that's important.
So what do you do looking at something like this? And you say, well, we have these elected officials, but even on that level, people can get very cynical.
They can. Well, you know, one of the things that, I mean, and I, since I don't live in Maine, I'd be curious on how it's working. But one of the things I wrote about in Soul of a Citizen is the the genesis of the Clean Elections Act in Maine, which I found very heartening. I mean, the woman that I profiled, just an ordinary mother named Allison Smith, who was involved with the League of Women Voters, went all around the state talking to editorial boards and town meetings and whatnot about the need to move forward, and just sort of said, I don't want my kids living in a cynical world. We've got to do something. And you obviously have, you know, much clearer sense than I do, I'm based in Washington State, of how it's played out in this first election where people have actually run. But I know I was getting passed on letters from people on both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans both, who were saying things like, before I would have to listen to my donors first, and then my constituents, and then my conscience. Now I just have to listen to my constituents and my conscience. One person who was going, collecting the $5 contributions they needed at the Cub Scout meeting. I don't know, I found that very, very heartening, because that's not what people do in most states if they're trying to raise money to run for office. They don't go to the Cub Scout meeting. And it seems to me that that has the potential, and I'm sure it's going to take some time to really fill this, you know, fill it out, of really affecting how politics is done in this country, especially when you couple with the subsequent victories in Arizona and Massachusetts and Vermont, and, you know, I think some other states will be signing on, you know, as time goes by as well. You're really trying to change the way that politics is so corrupted by money. I found it very, very heartening.
I'm going to tack back just a little bit. You speak in Chapter 1 about being able to face ourselves in the mirror and take stock of ourselves. I think that's kind of where it begins for many people.
Oh, yeah.
Being able to just say, I can't live with myself this way any longer, so what are my choices here?
Well, the central image that everybody who I've interviewed and Soul of a Citizen uses is they say, I want to look myself in the mirror and know that I try. Which is not the same thing as always succeeding, in the least. But it's saying, I want to know that I did my best I could. I tried, I owe it to my children, I owe it to my community, I owe it to myself. And that's what the image of looking in the mirror is. It's sort of saying, okay, well, if I'm going to be judged, and if I'm judging myself, it's not about perfection, but I do want to know that I tried. And that's very, very important. I mean, I think of this wonderful woman that I profile, a friend of mine who died at 101 last spring. Amazing woman named Hazel Wolf, she got, for her first political action, she wanted to play basketball. This is like 1909, and she was 11 years old. And she said, oh, well, girls can't play basketball. We all know that. And she sort of said, well, yes, we can. You give us the equipment, we'll show you. And her principal sort of was dumbfounded to be sort of talked back to by this mouthy, 11-year-old, and sort of gave her the equipment. And then she went on to become a labor activist, organized unions all around Washington State. She was actually involved in one of the first public pension systems in the country that became a model for Social Security, and she actually lived off that for 36 years. And what's interesting is that she spent her last maybe almost 40 years as an environmental activist, especially on environmental justice issues. Worked a lot with Audubon Society, organizing chapters around Washington State. And when she was 100 years old, she had a birthday party. And it was amazing because there were like 600 people packing a hall. And I was just thinking, and 300 more wanted to come in, but it was just full. And every one of them had a story to tell about Hazel. That's her name, Hazel Wolf, and how much she'd influenced them. And I was thinking, boy, you know, this is the kind of life you'd want to live. It's not materially rich. I mean, she had this little tiny apartment, an old battered car she drove till it dropped. But what a powerful life, and what an influence. And who could ask for anything more? And so I think that, you know, in a way, it comes back to that central issue, which is these are choices that we all have to make. Do we get engaged or not? And it's not to say that they're sometimes frustrating, difficult, all the rest. But they also give something back, and they give back that richness and that sense of purpose. And that's what I saw, you know, in that packed auditorium for Hazel Wolf. It's just, these are people who really were touched by her life. And, you know, none of us know how long we're going to have on this planet, but at the end of it, I'd sure like to feel like I'd done a fraction of what Hazel Wolf accomplished. That would be a life worthwhile.
Yeah, I often wonder with people whether they end up getting sick from inaction as much.
Yeah,
you know,
yes, yes.
By not doing what their soul sings for them to be doing.
Just, I mean, how much time do most of us spend, you know, just watching the disgruntled at the TV or listening to the radio or reading the newspaper? Oh, God, they're doing this again. How can they? That eats you away. And then, of course, the alternative is sort of saying, well, I'm not going to listen to any of it. You know, that does something to you also.
Yeah, I've done that.
We all have.
Yeah, so as far as this election, oh, where was I going to go with this question? Yes, as far as any heartening stories around a similar situation like this, are there any you can think of?
As far as the election goes?
As far as what's going on right now with this election, yeah, with this current crisis in the country.
This is what it seems to me. Clearly, people did turn out in many states and get passionately involved, and it did make a difference.
But, I mean, is there a precedent to this? Is there anything that you can say, yes, here was a situation, people took action, and this is what happened in the past?
Oh, well, I mean, there was a Miami election that got overturned three years ago, in the mayor's race. I mean, so the state of Florida, it is not unknown for elections
to
get overturned.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, with the fraud, there was some very obvious fraud in that case. But, you know, and this may be a mixture of just intimidation and incompetence and power politics. But, you know, so, yeah, elections have gotten overturned. I think, you know, you have to do what you can. And you know, we're not going to be able to control the outcome, but you do the best you can. And I sent out this email. Somebody wrote me back and said, you know, I live in Miami. I can't remember, Winter Park by Orlando. You know, I'm firing off this letter to the Miami Herald today. Well, you know, maybe his letter won't get in, but maybe somebody else's will, or maybe his letter will get in. And maybe it'll help people think about it a little bit differently. You can't control it. I mean, I think that, you know, this is the lesson of Rosa Parks, me, is you do the best you can. And for 12 years, she's fighting a losing battle, and then somehow one of the many things that she does helps tip the balance, and you see a visible result. But everything that's fed into it, all the 12 years before, and all the other uphill fights that everybody else did, those are part of it too. You know, or Nelson Mandela sitting in a South African jail for 27 years. You know, that's a long time. I think that the, how to describe it, there are times of crisis. I think that this is one of them. I think it's important for people to be out there raising their voices in whatever ways they can. But sometimes that works in the immediate sense. And sometimes what it does is, if you do it intelligently and well, it lays the ground for the future. And you can't always tell which it's going to be. You just can't.
Right.
You got to just, you know, this is the theme of Soul of a Citizen, is you do the best you can and you let go of it. Hazel Wolf, the 101-year-old woman, she says, well, you can't do everything, but you do what you can, and then you do some more, and you can do that your whole life. And you just keep on doing it, because if you do it long enough, and if enough people do it, and we do it in a way that enlists enough people, we see our society change in a way that's beneficial. And if we sit back, well, unfortunately, there's some very powerful and, I think, in some ways fairly destructive interests that wield a lot of control over where things go, and they certainly will be in there weighing in about the direction of our country. And that's the contest in some ways. That's the struggle we face, is just to try and reclaim democracy and say, well, okay, maybe I don't, you know, maybe my neighbors and I don't agree on everything, but let's try a situation where at least our voices get heard, because we are just, you know, we're regular individuals and we're citizens of this country, and in democracy, we should be the ones at the helm of it.
I'm looking at this Gloria Steinem quote that you have in Chapter 3 as I'm kind of buzzing quickly through this as we're wrapping up the program here, and saying that we do know that growth comes from saying yes to the unknown. I mean, ultimately, isn't it about just a personal, honoring your person enough to say, my voice is important? Isn't that what the founding fathers of democracy, so to speak, came? Wasn't that the purpose there?
I think it's honoring yourself. It's saying, I'm not going to be servile. I'm not going to be cynical. I'm not going to be passive. I am going to act. Maybe I don't know everything, and I probably don't. None of us do. Maybe I don't know how everything's going to turn out. But again, I can do the best I can, and that connects, and I can keep on doing that, and I can keep raising my voice about the issues that matter, and that connects me to who I am as a human being. That connects me to why I'm on the planet. And then, you know, that's the message of Soul of a Citizen, is that kind of connection versus the disconnection and the cynicism that's fed by our culture, where people just say, you know, don't bother, don't try, nothing's going to matter. Well, I think it does matter. It just, you know, it's not always easy, it's not always instant.
Right, and sometimes you'll never know. I think that's true.
And sometimes you'll never know. I mean, you won't know. You're trying to make it, whatever the issue is. Maybe something local, maybe something huge and national. And you bring somebody into it. And maybe you lose on that issue, but that person goes on to do something else tremendously powerful. You may never know it. I mean, you know, do we know the name of the person who encouraged Rosa Parks at that point, and I'm sure there were many of those points when she hit her wall in her moment of darkness and said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to continue on. Because everybody has that. Do we know the name of that person? No, we don't. Was that person a critical part of that process? Absolutely. So in any situation, there's all these nameless people who could be us who make a critical difference and often never even know the difference.
Okay, last thing I want to ask you is about this Allison Smith, seeing as she's a local woman that people can relate to. Yeah. Can you speak on that a bit?
Well, what I like about Allison is she's just this sort of regular, unpretentious woman. She was originally in Connecticut and got involved with the League of Women Voters because there was literally some developers like violated local law to build in a wetland, and no one was speaking up at the town council, and she was just like totally intimidated. She's somebody that didn't go to college, so totally intimidated. Like, you know, who am I? And she was sort of shaking and scared. And she just sort of speaks up and she says, well, you know, I think this is wrong. And then all of a sudden everyone else is saying, yeah, we're so glad you said that, Allison. You know, you know, you took the lead. We were thinking that too. We were going to say something, but they didn't. And then she got a little bit more involved, got involved with the league, moved to Maine, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. Got involved with the league chapter there, worked on a kind of interesting, it was sort of a marine oil law, where essentially what they did is say, we want to make sure that people aren't dumping oil into the sea, but we also want to be able to take account of the interests of the commercial fishermen and the small charter boat people and really bring the stakeholders together. And she thought it was a really neat process. I mean, sometimes you can do that. Sometimes you're up against adversaries who are just totally ruthless and you can't do that. But in this case, she felt like it was a real useful thing. But she kept hitting up against all the environmental work she did, and she, that was her primary area of involvement, she kept hitting up against the power of money. And that just, you know, whoever bought and sold the fundraising campaigns for the legislature, they were the ones who called the shot far too often. And so when that Clean Elections campaign started, she volunteered. And again, when people would say, well, could you speak to this group? She would think, well, you know, why me? I'm not an expert. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a, you know, political scientist. I'm just this mother who raises my kids and works and, you know, tries to get by. And nonetheless, people said, well, because you're passionate about it. And she was and is. And so, you know, her basic straightforward sense was, look, I don't want my kids growing up in a world this cynical, and we can do something about it. And I don't know if we can solve everything completely. We can move things forward. And that's what I think occurred. And it was, you know, it was interesting about that initiative is no one thought it was going to pass, but it got a majority of Democrats, Republicans, independents, every county but one in the state. And I think it was because ordinary people often have, you know, if you get an issue really explained well and if you get their neighbors talking to them and you get those discussions going, you know, often we do have common sense and we do respond. And things that seem absolutely impossible suddenly become possible. And to me, that's the process of change. Which is, you know, you see something, you think, oh, my God, it could never occur. I mean, my God, would you ever think that Nelson Mandela would have imagined himself president of South Africa? I mean, I think he was doing that for his grandkids, you know, as were all those other people in that fight. And yet, suddenly, history turns. And again, you never know the moment, which is critical. But I would say that, you know, if you look, I don't know how long it's going to be. 5 years would be great. 10 years. If it takes 20 or 30, it's worth it. Look back, and we finally get campaign finance reform, the election in Maine is going to be a pivotal step. There's no question about it because it was the first. So you look at that and you think of the ordinary people involved in that, that would make you pretty proud. And now, you know, now the challenge in part, I would say, is to, you know, really take advantage of the new laws. That is to have ordinary citizens running and just saying, okay, this is what democracy ought to be about. And then to get the story out and to say, look, hey, we did this and it works. And maybe it's not perfect. And maybe it doesn't solve all that problem, but we've moved things forward. And if we can do it here in Maine, there's no reason that other folks can't do it as well.
Well, don't you think, too, that hearing the voice of an average person gives most people someone to relate to? There's a language that they understand. There's an energy that they understand because that's someone on their level.
Yeah.
So when this woman, Allison Smith, stepped forward, and when any number of these people step forward, there are people who are willing to, very tenuously sometimes, jump on the bandwagon and support what their platform is simply because there's someone, again, that they can relate to. It's not someone in a three-piece suit.
It's not somebody in a three-piece suit with a PhD or whatever, or, you know, a huge PR budget. It's just an ordinary person. And when we think about, well, who will listen to us? Because we're only whatever we are. Part of the answer is maybe they'll listen more to us.
Yeah.
Because we're an ordinary citizen trying to figure this out along with everybody else. We have all the ordinary pressures. And we're like the people we're trying to reach.
Yeah, so let's figure it out together.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We're figuring it out together. And those folks, you know, who get flown in on the high-rolling budgets and whatnot, on some level, they're not like the people we're trying to reach. They live in a different world, in a more sheltered world, in a world that maybe is the beneficiary of a huge social divide. And so I think in some ways we have more power. We just, you know, we're hesitant to exercise it. We don't think we have the standing. So again, you know, part of what I try to do in Soul of a Citizen is give people that confidence that says, yeah, you know, if you care about something, learn about it, keep open-minded, you know, learn from the people on the other side so that if you're wrong about something, you can correct it. But don't be afraid to get involved because you've got to be able to take that first step.
Any parting comments you want to give to the listeners?
Just that they listen to what they care about. I mean, I think I'll mention the website again just because I think it's a useful way to,
yeah, please
to
do.
Check out some of the stuff about the book. And I promise to have some of the election stuff up on it as well. It's www.soulofacitizen.org. But I think, you know, what it really comes down to is we have, you know, a life to live. And we have choices that we make. And in this life, we can choose to try and take the risk of speaking out for what we believe, or we can say it's not going to matter. And I would just argue that it's a lot richer way to live if we speak out for what we believe.
And we'll never know unless we try.
And we'll never know unless we try.
I want to thank you for being a part of the program today. And again, to let people know, that is the way they can reach the information that we're putting out here is website www.soulofacitizen.org. I want to thank Paul Rogat-Loeb for being on the program. And we'll see you again next month.
Hey, take care. Glad to be on the show.
Thanks, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Support for WERU comes from the Whole Health Center in Bar Harbor, since 1981 providing counseling, emotional recovery work, and holistic health care services, including stress management and meditation, massage and neuromuscular therapy, and nutrition and herbal health care. The Whole Health Center, 288-4128.
You scared, Ready?
No, but I'm scared. I might get scared.
Senator Holly S. Abel here. My fellow Americans, the long national nightmare of peace and prosperity has been ended by a combination of dexterous duplicity, mendacious prevarication, and legislative legerdemain, coupled with ham-fisted diplomacy backed by sheer unadulterated brute force. We have made great strides in tugging the proverbial wool over the dazed eyes of the body politic, but there is so much...